So, good morning again. Questions? If you have them, I will take them. Otherwise, I'll start with another episode.
Yes. There is a phrase saying, if you encounter the Buddha, kill him. And let's say the intuition I have, and I would like to hear you about that if possible, is that from this act arises a very deep solitude, ultimate solitude, and from that, because everyone is in that case, deep compassion can arise, and I would like just to hear you about that.
Is there a question there?
It's not really a question, just a different question. Is there any link between feeling deep solitude and compassion, something like that?
I can't answer for you, if you feel there's a link. I would ask you, however, what is the Buddha? If you say, if you meet the Buddha, kill it. First you have to know what the Buddha is. You have to, what is it?
Do you want me to answer?
Sure, if you want to.
I can enter personal saying if it's a place I can. If maybe you want to speak more general, I don't say anything.
If I want to?
If you want to speak more generally, I can answer for me, but maybe it's not really the point here. I don't know, I can.
It's your question. So,
I can see how I keep. I don't know if grasping is the word, grasping to the lineage. And maybe in that way avoiding the fact that I can be really, really, really alone, feeling deep solitude. And maybe avoiding to feel this deep solitude, I prevent also myself to feel I guess, deep compassion for others.
You because prevent yourself.
I don't go really into my own solitude.
Since I'm not I'm not sure what the question is in the in all of this.
Maybe can you speak about the phrase, if you encounter the Buddha, kill him, just
okay.
Get the other things.
Okay. Well, oddly enough, as with yesterday when you suggested talking about death, the passage that I had picked today, I didn't really pick it, actually, let's say. I flipped through briefly the book and then put it aside. And then when I came to sit, I even said to Lisa, I don't know if I'll take the book, you know, if I want it, I'll tell you to bring it, I don't know. And I sat then, and then at the last minute when she was going and she turned around and I said, yes, okay, bring it. And I had in mind a passage, and it touches on this question. So, once again, the perfect question for the moment. And also, before I read the passage, I might say that lately I've been thinking of, you know, we always talk about the Buddha. And the Buddha said this, and the Buddha did that, and when the Buddha, and because of the Buddha, and thanks to the Buddha, and if you meet the Buddha, kill the Buddha, and all this and that. I've been thinking of saying instead, when I talk about, well, the Buddha said this, or the Buddha did that, of saying Siddhartha, because that was his name. You know, that was, the guy had a name, you know, it's like saying Bob. Care or something, you know? Bob the Builder. Kind of like Bob the Builder.
Bob the Sponge. Bob the Builder.
Sponge. So I've been thinking of, recently in the past couple of months, saying Siddhartha instead of Buddha. But maybe that's a bit of a gimmick or something, you know. Because gimmick, do you know what that means? A trick.
Gimmick, yeah. A trick.
The point being that we, you know, kind of like when Trungpa, the Tibetan master Trungpa came to the West, he took off his robes and he took away all the Tibetan pizzazz and bells and whistles and incense and flowers and all of that stuff. Because he didn't want people to join with him and come and hear him because of all of that. He wanted them to come and hear the teaching and to hear the message, but not that wasn't the message he wanted. So. And we have a tendency with when we say the Buddha to make it into something, right? Something that it's not. So that also ties in with this. And we might also think, you know, I sit here hour after hour looking at that statue there, and it's quite remarkable that the statue we choose throughout Buddhism is some guy just sitting there, right? It's not any sort of symbolic, you know, the cross has great symbolism and evolves from this terrible martyrdom and suffering. And so in the Christian religion, the cross has this symbolism. Sometimes, you know, often there is the Christ suffering on the cross.
There's one over there.
Is there? Yeah. Where? Yeah.
Across the street, left.
Right. Whereas for us, It's just this guy sitting there, doing nothing. What does that say then about what our practice is and what is the point then we're making with this symbol? And sometimes it's, you know, you say sometimes it's a rock, in the kitchen it's a potato, in the abandoned schoolyard it's a beer can. What are we saying with that, right?
I'm thinking of the potato in the kitchen.
Exactly, that's it. So we have Bob the Builder and Mr. Potato Head. So,
yeah. What is the name? When you say the name, what is it?
Bob the Builder.
It's
the children's books.
Mm-hmm. It's a children's character.
Bob the Builder. So you go for this, is that?
Me. Mais c'est intrinsèquement drôle. Because of the alliteration, it's funny.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The sounds.
Yeah.
So, that's all. And then SpongeBob is another children's character, which is Joe O'Brien. And he has square pants.
Yeah.
Forget it. Okay. So I will read this passage and then we'll address. I haven't forgotten the question. If I can find the passage now, because I don't think I marked it. But I will find it. I marked it with pencil, I just didn't mark it before. Yeah, or I just happened upon this where it says Shakyamuni, we also refer to him as Shakyamuni, means the sage of the Shakya clan. So already we're, you know, attaching something to him that is maybe more than what we need to say. It's here somewhere. You know what? I'm just going to tell the story, maybe. It's too bad.
Pencil writing.
I have it here somewhere. Anyway, let's just. So, you know, many of you have probably heard this. The story of how do you step forward from a... Ah, here we go. Okay. So he says, those who study the path must let go of mind and body and enter wholly into the way of the Buddha. So here we go. Here he is. Right? Into the way of Shakyamuni, into the way of Siddhartha. An ancient one said, atop a 100-foot pole, how will you step forward? 100 feet is about 35 meters, I think, something like that. Thus, having climbed to the top of a 100-foot pole, there is a mind which thinks it will die if it lets go of its foothold, and so holds fast. The admonition to take a step forward means that having concluded that it would not be bad, then, so as to cast off body and life, one must deliberately abandon everything, from his worldly occupations to his lifetime career ambitions. As long as he does not abandon this, no matter if he studies the way with the same urgency as beating out a fire on his head, it would still be impossible to attain the way. You must settle your resolve and cast off body and mind together. So he's being a little extreme with this, but that's not a bad thing.
In French?
Oui. Okay, donc, ceux qui étudient le chemin doivent lâcher l'esprit et le corps et entrer entièrement sur la voie de Bouddha, de Shakyamuni, de Siddhartha, etc. Un ancien a dit, en haut d'un un mât de 50 mètres, comment on dit ?
Pilier.
Quoi ?
Pilier.
Oui, pilier peut-être.
Un mât.
Ouais. De 30 mètres. Comment prendre un pas en avant ? Donc, ayant grimpé jusqu'en haut de ce mât de 35 mètres, il y a un esprit qui pense qu'il va mourir s'il lâche. Et donc, il s'accroche. L'incitation de prendre un pas en avant veut dire que, ayant conclu que ce ne sera pas mauvais, donc, que ce ne sera pas mauvais de lâcher le corps et la vie, en pleine conscience, on lâche tout. De toutes ces préoccupations du monde, jusqu'à ses carrières de toute sa vie. Tant qu'il n'a pas lâché tout ça, même s'il étudie la voie avec la même urgence que s'il avait qu'il éteignait un feu sur sa tête, ce sera toujours impossible d'arriver. Il faut donc établir ton resolve, ton résolution,
détermination,
et laisser tomber corps et esprit. Ok, c'est une traduction, ça va. So when we say to step forward from a 100-foot pole, in fact, it doesn't say you must step forward from a 100-foot pole. It says, how do you step forward from a 100-foot pole? And in this question that Brigitte posed, we might also say, how do you kill the Buddha when you meet him? Rather than giving an order of, when you meet the Buddha, kill him. How do you kill the Buddha when you meet him? How do you step forward from a 100-foot pole? And when I was sitting, I was reminded, when I was thinking of this, I was reminded of another Zen story where there's two monks going on some sort of pilgrimage, and they meet a woman beside a river, and she wants to cross the river. And they're crossing the river too, but she doesn't know how to swim. And so one of the monks carries her across. And then the monks continue on their way. She goes her way, they go their way. And after a few hours, the second monk says to the first one, I can't believe you did that. Among our precepts are, you must not touch a woman. And not only did you touch this woman, but you actually carried her. You didn't just shake her hand, you carried her. I can't believe you did that. You know, you violated the precepts. And the first monk says, yes, I did carry her. And I put her down hours ago. And you are still carrying her.
Juste avant, je
l'avais déposée il y a des heures. Et toi, tu les portes toujours. Do you want to translate?
No. Later. Since I have to speak a bit louder.
You want me to speak louder?
Yes.
Okay. I will try. Usually that's something that people ask my teacher, is to speak louder. No, people usually tell me to speak louder. It's interesting. So, how do all of these things relate? Killing the Buddha, how do you kill the Buddha, how do you step forward? We can say that the first monk, by meeting the woman, picking her up and crossing the road, swimming across the river with her, steps forward from the pole, kills the Buddha, functions freely, as we say. What does it mean to step forward from a pole? Sometimes that phrase, it's actually a koan that we use in our training, sometimes it's interpreted that as this 100-foot pole is a lofty place where we've arrived, we've seen the Absolute, we think that we've encountered enlightenment, we're awakened, whatever, and we must then come down off of our pedestal. Often it's treated in that way, this koan. And that's not, there's nothing wrong with that treatment or interpretation. We can take it a step further. We can step forward from that pole and see that this pole, this 30-foot pole, is wherever we are. It's not necessarily something lofty and extraordinary. It's wherever we are at any moment. And in order to meet the moment, we step forward. We have to step forward to meet the moment. It's not that we're stuck in some amazing place. Usually where we're, quote, stuck, we don't even really like. We don't like, you know, we're uncomfortable. We're bored. We're sad. We're frustrated. We're confused. We need to step forward from that. Whatever it is, wherever we are, step forward. So that's why I asked, you know, when I asked Brigitte, what is the Buddha? So, you know, there was a novel that was written maybe almost 20 years ago in the U.S., and it was a real popular novel. I can't even remember what the title of it was, but in the novel, there is a Zen group, a Zen center, and some guy in the Zen group knows of that phrase, if you encounter the Buddha, kill the Buddha, and gets up in the middle of the meditation period and takes the kizaku, you know, the stick that they used to hit people, and kills the master. So it's kind of this murder mystery thing, you know. And that's just one indication of how this phrase is easily misinterpreted. So first, before we resolve that question or answer that question, we need to resolve what is the Buddha? What is killing? We need to resolve what is the 100-foot pole? What is a step forward? And these are all questions that go strike to the heart of this practice. It's like, what does that mean? The statue that we put there is just some guy sitting. Well, what does that mean? He sits there. And we sit here all day. What does that mean? What is that? And I don't mean what does that mean in let's read books and study and figure out the tradition of what the origins of that phrase or why this ancient, as Dogen refers to him, talked about a 100-foot pole. You know, probably there's some symbolism, and we don't care. It doesn't matter. What matters is us. What, for me, what does that mean? What does it mean, solitude? What does it mean, compassion? What does it mean, deep? What? Everything is question, 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 question. That's stepping forward from the 100-foot pole. Question, question, question. And then what happens when we step forward? You know, we, as he says, what keeps us, what prevents us from that? There's this mind that thinks that it will die if it lets go. They think that if we step forward, we will die. Maybe that we will be alone. Maybe that, I don't know what solitude means in your thing, but it could be an equivalent of death. Often we associate the two. Not in the way that we usually think, but it's kind of like, if I'm alone, then I don't exist or something. Or my existence will be threatened or whatever. So we have this mind that believes that if it lets go, it will die. Which is not untrue. What does that mean? That it dies. Well, what does that mean? It's not untrue. And these are all the questions that we face if we truly, you know, as he says here, throw ourselves into it. And when he says, you know, we abandon... deliberately abandon everything, from worldly preoccupations to lifetime career. Again, what does that mean, to abandon? What is worldly preoccupations? What is lifetime career? What is he talking about there? Often those things are misinterpreted and have given rise to this idea that... particularly in the West, actually, it's been misinterpreted and become this thing where people thought they had to give up their homes and their jobs and their families and shave their heads and wear special clothing in order to realize what he's talking about here. When in fact the only thing that has to be dropped when we're talking about worldly preoccupations and lifetime career is the attachment to this identity, to the identification with all of those things. It doesn't mean you have to change the way you dress or shave your head or leave your home and give away all your money. It could. For some people that might be the way. But that's not an obligation. You can do that and still be attached to that and still not have taken a step off the 100-foot pole. So the horses pass. And what arises? I wait and see. And that reminds me of, I have told this before, many, many years ago in Nijmegen, where both of you maybe were there at the time. You were there, I think, probably. When I was just starting to teach and I didn't really like doing this, giving talks. And I did a lot of that kind of sitting here waiting to see what came up. And then I would say something and then I would wait again to see what came up and then say something. And at the end of the... And I often would say that I didn't like giving talks, so it wasn't a secret. You know. And at the end of the retreat, there was a big lunch and a lot of people. And I was sitting with some people, and my teacher was there too. And some guy was sitting there, and he said, "So do you? You still don't like giving talks?" Because he had heard me say that in previous years too, probably. And I said, "Yeah, I don't really like it so much, but it's getting a little easier. But I don't like it." And he said, "Yeah, you know, I can tell your talks are kind of boring." And I was devastated. I was really...
Only in Holland.
Devastated. And, you know, I was like on the verge of tears, and because I was still very unsure of everything. Not that I'm sure of it now, but it's different now. And my teacher immediately said to him, "The Dharma is not entertaining." Which was beautiful. And then my tears became tears of gratitude. And it's true. It's not entertaining. So, you know, we hear this stuff about letting it go, taking a step forward. It's not entertainment. And we sit here on our cushions, and often we find ourselves looking for entertainment, even if we don't think of it as entertainment. You know, we're like chewing on some drama or obsessing with some conversation we had 6 years ago and still plagues us, or feeling really uncomfortable and bored and tired and hanging with that, hanging onto it, dwelling with it.
Je suis pas sûre de comprendre. Tu continues sur le fait que la pratique n'est pas entertainment, ça veut dire spectacle, c'est ça?
Oui,
le divertissement.
Divertissement,
d'accord. Ouais. Et tu parles aussi de... Je n'ai pas compris la suite.
Et donc, souvent, on se retrouve sur notre coussin en train de chercher le divertissement.
Ouais.
Même si c'est quelque chose...
De dramatique.
Qui ne nous plaît pas, qui est difficile, ouais. Qui... on n'arrive pas à résoudre ce problème, ou quelqu'un, on a un problème avec une relation difficile avec quelqu'un, ou on se sent fatigué, triste, en colère, les choses qu'on dirait entre guillemets négatives, ça nous divertit aussi.
Ça nous divertit de.
De ce qui est, voilà. Ici maintenant.
Diverti dans le sens.
Oui.
Dispert, détour.
To amuse. Yeah.
Yeah. Even if it's not funny. Mm. You know.
It's giving a thrill.
Right.
C'est-à-dire?
A thrill.
Sensation.
Jouissance.
Jouir. Yeah.
A thrill is a titillant, ce qui est titillant.
No, actually, on that exact subject, it occurred to me for the first time this morning while I was sitting that this tradition is very manly. I mean, it was founded by Shakyamuni, who's a man, and there's like all those monks and mostly men in monasteries.
Officially,
mostly. And it occurred to me that it's... And while I was sitting, I was always, before coming here, Delphine was going to the south of France. So I thought, oh God, on one hand, there's like meditation retreats, sitting on a cushion, like 9 hours a day. On the other hand, I could be sailing. And it's like, ooh, what do I do? It's complicated. And it occurred to me that it's, I think for men, it's, I mean, I see from my personal experience, but I think it's like that with other men. We have a lot of energy to spend. Like, les hommes, ils sont des commerciaux, and they need to go with a lot of things and do things and do sports, and because there's a lot of energy going on. And it's a lot of constraint to be sitting on a cushion for like 9 hours a day for men. It's like, it's weird, suddenly it occurred to me that it's very strange that this tradition actually structured around an activity which is, in a way, very counter-natural for men. It's mm-hmm. very strange. I mean, it requires a lot of energy to... A lot of constraint. It's a lot of constraint to say, I'm going to be just sitting on a cushion and not hiking and not... I mean, it could be like a tradition of walking in the forest.
Well, and there are some. Like,
and you know, in fact, when I thought about that, I thought... They did spend actually a lot of time walking because they were begging and they were outside, and probably the time where they actually spent on the cushion was actually much more limited compared to what we do now, because we don't need to beg and we don't need to be outside and go running and in the forest. And on top of it, the period while they were meditating during the year was actually limited. It wasn't the whole year.
Although they did have daily practice.
Yeah, they did have daily practice, but the other time they were in the field and all that, and they were like doing other things and begging and going on pilgrimage and all kinds of activity. Mm. So I thought there's something for me that suddenly it struck me how, I mean, what I'm just saying is that it's very difficult for me now to stay like for 9 hours and that, you know, I want to be like,
Look for amusement or action?
Not really, or like
activity. Or?
Like that, the energy is like, what do you do with that energy?
Mm.
It's difficult to actually burn that energy. It's like eating, and you're fueling your gas tank, and you're actually not running your car. Mm. It feels like that a little bit.
Mm.
It's like you put some food, and it's like nothing happens really.
Mm.
for me, I am a very active person, but sitting on a question, my mind is constantly active, really active, and so it for me it is actually the same as writing a book, for example, what Monique is doing. And it's a tremendous energy you have. You have to create, to sit here and see what the mind is doing. Of course, you don't use your muscles, but the activity in the head is it costs a lot of energy.
Well, and maybe we can say that. This is a good illustration of the oneness and the diversity, because whatever our positions, whatever our places, whatever our energy levels or age or sex or position in life and whatever, we still have to face the same issue. And everyone had, you know, Dominique sits in a chair, in a wheelchair, she can't use her legs. She has, that's part of her situation.
Issue, c'est problème, issue?
Not necessarily a problem.
Situation?
Aspect, characteristique. Mm-hmm. We all come to this with the same. Ultimately, the same position of being a human being, and what does that then? And it doesn't matter so much if we're a monk or not, or if we're a man or a woman, or if we're sitting in a chair and we can't use our legs, or if we're blind or deaf, or whatever it is. The question ultimately is then, how do we respond to that circumstance? How do we step forward from that pool, whatever it is? And the response will be different every time, and the response will be different from every person. And you know, I saw when Joel was talking, I said officially, because there's a lot of research that's been happening in the past, I don't know, quarter century or so, that has in fact uncovered that there were a lot of women also doing this.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a whole lineage of women who they've uncovered who they just weren't recorded. That was how this culture functioned, and that they weren't part of the official books, as you said, as we would say. And
but they were allowed.
Yeah, well, even some people say that one of Bodhidharma's successors was a woman, was the daughter of the emperor who he encounters. But unofficially, because official things that are official, that's masculine. Being official is masculine, and record books and competitions and all that is part of the, in hierarchies, it's part of the masculine world. Women also participate in that. It's not that women don't, but it's a masculine characteristic, whereas women also can have that characteristic, but it's part of the masculine energy of the world. So, in any case, then, wherever we are, you know, if we have a busy mind or pent-up energy or whatever it is, how do we then step forward? And ultimately, then the question comes back to, well, who? Okay, so who? We all have some sort of identity, whether it be identifying as a man, identifying as a woman, identifying as a businessman, identifying as an artist, identifying as a mother, as someone who's lonely, whatever it is, whatever your identity is. How do we step forward from that? Who is the Buddha and who is killing? What does it mean to kill the Buddha? Implies also who is killing the Buddha and what does that mean? So,
in the story you told about the two monks, who one of whom carries the woman over the river, I don't know whether I misunderstood or interpreted it wrongly, but his contravening the rules, did you mean that to mean that he had killed the Buddha because he had gone beyond the form to the I can't remember what we call it, between the form and the
emptiness or formlessness, yeah, or the absolute, or
Is that what you meant, or did I just get that all wrong?
I don't even think we need to go into that kind of jargon about it.
I'm still totally puzzled about what killing the Buddha means.
Right, yeah. And that's... I would never be able to answer it to your satisfaction.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's a response that you have to find for yourself.
Okay.
I can say about this case with the monks, however, and helping the woman across, he sees there's a situation that presents itself, he recognizes what needs to be done,
mm-hmm.
and he's not holding fast to his idea of who he is. I'm a monk, there's this rule, I can't touch a woman.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, he would just leave the woman there. He would say, well, fuck you, you know, mm-hmm. I can't touch you.
Mm-hmm.
And would be very attached to a dualistic point of view of me and you and who I am and what my identity is and what your identity is and whatever. And he steps forward from that position, whatever that is, and acknowledges that this is what needs to be done, just does it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he doesn't cling to that either.
Yeah.
He's not indulging in, wow, I love the feel of her hips. Or, you know, I wish she would take that dress off. Or whatever, you know, whatever you might suspect is being, you know, why he's not supposed to touch a woman. You know, theoretically, he's not supposed to be swayed from his path. She belongs to worldly preoccupations, and so his rule is not to be involved in that. So he puts her down and moves on, and steps down from that pole and moves on. Whereas his friend doesn't step down. He's stayed on that pole all this time. and is very much identified with who he is supposed to be and what the rules are. And, you know, a lot of these things, even today, you know, we have, there are Zen groups who traditionally do what they call a 3-month, they call it an Engo, which is a 3-month retreat period. And there are very few people in the modern world who can actually take 3 months out of their lives and go away and do this. So they modify it, and it goes on for 3 months, but only a few people actually do it, and others come and go, and they can. Originally, that all that was one, the Buddha was the Buddha, Siddhartha, and his people were forced to leave, often from wherever they were living, because they were not, they were ostracized for a number of reasons, but mainly because they integrated untouchables. They allowed untouchables to be part of their community. So they had to leave. And so they became roving monks, and they would go to another place and practice. So we adapted this thing where you go to another place and practice. And they, during the rainy season, instead of moving on, they would just stay set in one place, and the rainy season lasted about 3 months. And so they would just sit there for 3 months, basically in one place, as long as they could, because it was raining. And so we then, this has been perpetuated, and people do this 3-month thing in the summertime, so that, because that's what you're supposed to do.
When it arose,
even when it's not raining, or when it is raining. But it arose from a very concrete, necessary situation. And there's nothing wrong with doing a 3-month retreat.
As long as you kill the Buddha.
What?
As long as you kill the
yeah,
Buddha.
You know? Or, you know, the other story that I often tell is that in the Buddha's community, he wanted everyone to be the same. And he didn't want them to, therefore, covet any special clothing or objects. And this was related to the way that Indian society was situated, so that there were Brahmins and there were noble people and there were the untouchables. And he wanted them all to be the same. And so the Brahmins couldn't have their fancy clothes and fancy stuff and whatever, and everybody had the same. So they had to get fabric that they made their robes with, and they all had the same thing. Among the fabrics that they weren't allowed to have, however, was cotton, because it was considered very luxurious. And that became one of the precepts, was monks were not allowed to wear or touch cotton. And in some traditions, in the Theravada tradition, that still persists. That still is. And related to that, at the Zen Center in Los Angeles, years and years ago, some great Theravadan teacher was coming to visit, and the Zen Center was going to host him and have him live there, and he was going to practice with them. But all of their cushions and mats were made of cotton. The cloth was all cotton, and the sheets were cotton. So they had to find special fabric, make special sheets for him, and make a special seat and special cushion for him, which was exactly the point of the precept, was that he wasn't supposed to have anything special.
Yeah, so they completely...
Right.
Yeah.
Same thing with the guy helping the woman across the river. He's supposedly a bodhisattva, and he is supposed to serve others and be, encounter the moment as it is, and function according to what it is, and do whatever is necessary in that moment. If he holds fast to some rule that he's not supposed to touch a woman, well, then he's not paying attention to the moment, functioning freely. If he does take her, well, he breaks his precept. But is it possible to break that precept? You know, if you are not attached to who you are, mm-hmm. and to a fixed position, the precepts cannot be broken.
Mm-hmm. No, or you always break them.
Well, that's another. We are always breaking them.
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We're always breaking them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you cannot.
You cannot. No, they cannot be maintained.
Break them.
Right. So. Now we're getting into something else. Is it time? I noticed that they left.
It's 5 past 1.
Oh. Okay. So you decided you won't have lunch before you go.
I don't know. She said I'll come back, so I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, there's some lunch now if you want, but after, if you want it afterwards, it's fine. Because that's what they've gone to do. This for.
Oh, I thought she was preparing her stuff.
No, she's having ready. Lunch. She's having
oh,
lunch.
Oh, okay.
But you can eat after too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So now here's another example. If he were attached to his idea that he is the Eno, he wouldn't go take Christine to the station. His identity, he's the Eno. That's what he does. Nobody else can do it. He's the great one. His voice is perfect. Everyone else is not up to his level, whatever. You know. Or guilty. He feels guilt by leaving that position. All of that stuff would keep him from taking Christine to the station. He lets go of that identity and takes her to the station. In another case, it might be appropriate for him not to leave that position and someone else take Christine to the station. And we don't know. In this circumstance, that's what...
There's no absolute.
No. Well...
Well, there is.
The absolute is that there is no...
Yeah.
No fixed position. So. And yet, it makes a difference what we do.
Mm.
It's not that there's no fixed position, so it doesn't matter. There are very precise positions and circumstances, and absolutely everything we do matters. If you light the stick of incense, there will be smoke and odor. If you don't, there won't be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a difference, you know. That you have to go to do the serving time. So, maybe we should stop there and do a short Kinhin until we have, what, 5 or 10 minutes?
We've got more than 20 minutes.
Oh, I thought we were reading at 1:15.
Are we? No.
No, I'm really confused about this.
No.
It stays the same. We just started the talk earlier. So they could hear the talk.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier, and benefit more.
That he went back to 11:30 because so that they wouldn't miss too much of it. So that they wouldn't miss too much. Of it.
Okay. So, but Monique usually leaves 10 minutes before the meal, right? And she's leaving 20 minutes before. Is that?
Well, now you've got me asking the question. So
whatever.
1:30.
I did too, but then when Monique got up to leave, I became confused. I thought that was, that we were still eating at the same time.
I'm just not sure. I had understood it was 1:30, but maybe 1:50.
Okay. So now that we've said all of that, do you want to come back to your... Did that address the question? I'm not Yeah.
Maybe when asking that, I forgot the circumstances, and maybe in fact killing the Buddha is killing the Buddha, the way I understand it, for a moment or for an act, but the Buddha is not killed. I am acting according what I am feeling according to the circumstances, and in that way it's killing the Buddha, but the Buddha is not killed, and I can come back to
what is the Buddha, I ask again.
Cosmos.
Huh? Cosmos. The
cosmos? And you, how do you kill the cosmos?
For me it was Roshi and the lineage, and how I can maybe cling too much to that in certain circumstances, not being able to let go. And doing what I am feeling I have to do at certain moments. And but in the same mais ce qui ne m'empêche pas d'y revenir après et de comme un jeu entre non, je suis pas claire. Si en fonction des, I am sorry.
Oh, okay.
Si en fonction des circonstances, je sens que à un certain moment, je dois agir de telle façon, même si ça me paraît être en désaccord avec ce que je pense. Que j'imagine être de venant de Roshi ou du lignage, je le fais quand même. Mais en même, enfin, je sais pas. En résumé, je pourrais dire killing the Buddha, but the Buddha is not killed.
And I still come back to what is the Buddha. I remind you that the word the Buddha just means awakened, right? And we, as we say in this tradition, we all have Buddha nature. There are realized Buddhas and potential Buddhas, we say, right? And so then that's. We say that ordinary people see ordinary, you know.
Lay people?
Ordinary. And let's say Buddhas with a capital letter see Buddhas, and Buddhas with a little letter see ordinary people. Buddhas that aren't realized see ordinary people, and Buddhas who are realized see Buddhas. I say. I know that's just more confusion, but I come back to this notion of what is the Buddha. If you say Roshi and the lineage are the Buddha, is that different than the king hanging up his clothing and bowing down to it?
Juste la fin, la question.
Hier, on avait parlé de ce roi qui on avait ses vêtements superbes. Il mettait sur la porte-manteau. et se poster en un devant.
Et ta question,
est-ce que c'est la même chose?
Est-ce que c'est la même chose que de dire que Rishi et le lignage sont le Bouddha? I mean, you can burn those clothes.
Maybe which is more Buddha for me, maybe more than the lineage and Roshi. Maybe it would be more the teaching et les points de repère que ça me donne.
The teaching and the reference points?
Yes, teaching as a reference point. Yeah. Yeah, and the Dharma, and let's say.
And so, if that's the Buddha, what does killing that mean? Si ça c'est le Bouddha, tuer ceci, ça veut dire quoi?
To have faith in my own Buddha nature.
But I mean, how does that manifest? Killing it. Or do you mean it manifests by having faith in your own Buddha nature?
Yeah.
But isn't that what the teaching is?
Comment?
Isn't that what the teaching is?
Peut-être. Oui, mais.
Or what mais do you mean? What is the teaching
si
then?
J'avais pas assez de foi ou de confiance.
I think I want to step ahead of you. What is the teaching then for you?
What is the teaching? Comment résumer tout ce que j'ai entendu et ce que je sens si vrai?
It's better to stay with what you feel than with what you've heard.
Avoir confiance en mes capacités de donner sans qu'il y ait un je qui donne.
I'm going to translate. Have confidence in
the fact that I can give. I can. Yes, I can give. I can have compassion without me, which is giving, which without a constructed me. I am. Teaching, I am giving, I. And I think, yes, I am afraid of myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I don't have enough faith, but maybe it's good also. I don't have enough faith in my, let's say, my Buddha nature and the fact that I can react according to the circumstances. Okay, I react, but without putting me at the head of this reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because of that, all this story about the teaching and the lineage, I am grasping to that because of my fear. Of myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's tricky because maybe the next step for me would be to take the risk to let go in a certain way to let go of the teaching, to let go of all the story about the lineage, about Rashi's teaching, and just acting and seeing what I am doing, and just being aware of putting your me or not, or just responding to the circumstances, just being able to have faith and to see, to be aware of what happened.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And is that different than the teaching? Is that?
It's not different. It's not different from the teaching, but it's different from making the teaching a thing and clinging to it, what I am doing right now.
And by wanting to give and wanting to share, or whatever, I forget exactly the words you used, there was that notion, right? Of wanting to give and not have me
taking pride,
right? Proud of it, or involved in it, or doing, or something.
Maybe there is a me who wants to see that he's not doing that.
Exactly. That's true. Absolutely. Yeah. So you, I, that wasn't how I was going to say it, but that's exactly it. Yeah. And so there is, what is there that's to give? And who is there to give it to whom?
Nothing and nobody, just doing, and maybe someone who is looking can say she is giving, but in fact I am not giving, I am just responding.
So maybe stepping forward from the pole in this case is letting go of this idea that, or this desire that you're clinging to give. Because there's very much a someone in that kind of situation. There's a someone who is objectifying something and another.
You know, in the workshop I made last week, I told you about, I saw myself like a tuyau,
a tube.
Just from just giving, but giving not from myself, just from what I learned, and just restitute it, or something like that.
Channel.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, the lineage. When I see things like that, lineage is really important for me.
And why?
Ça revient au début, en fait.
And so then what is about the killing that is, how does that relate?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What needs to be killed? What is it that the question, because that was your initial question. I'm not sure I see how that ties in. Because if you're just giving, I mean, already there's someone. If there's giving, there's someone, and there's something, and there's someone else.
I don't want to.
Right? What?
I don't want to be the one who is giving.
Right. So then you have to let go of the giving.
Mm.
And of what you think is being given. And of the giver. And the receiver. That's the pole to step forward to.